everybody. I'd like to welcome you all to this anthology launch tonight. We've got a lot of poets. We've got 11 poets reading, so I think we should get started fairly promptly. I'd just like to say a few words before we start about the anthology. In 1982, when Philip Larkin was the librarian at the Bryn Mawr Jones Library, and when Douglas Dunn was writer in residence at the university, there was a group of poets meeting regularly, not connected to the university. Douglas Dunn went along to this group, got interested in these slightly younger writers, and the result of that was this classic book, A Rumoured City, with a lovely picture by Douglas Dunn's late wife, Leslie, on the cover. And that introduced 10 new poets from Hull who were just about, in some cases, just about to publish a first book, but in most cases not yet published. This is, I think, a classic. It's unrepeatable, and I haven't tried to repeat it. This isn't part two or a sequel or anything of that sort. But I did think that in this season of commemoration of Philip Larkin's life and work, that it would be interesting as part of that to revisit the poets whose work is collected in this original anthology, and to bring them together with some of the many other poets who are associated with the University of Hull and the city of Hull. It was a surprise to me to discover actually how many there were, and various people would say to me, oh, did you know this particular poet is a graduate of Hull or lived in Hull or had some association. It's interesting, and in the end I had 20, I think, or perhaps 19 poets, all with some kind of Hull association, in addition to the poets who were in the original Rumoured City. And weaving my co-editor and I, that's Ian Gregson, who's going to read later and talk to you a little bit later, we decided to include work by Douglas Dunn as well, because he modestly left himself out of the first anthology. We haven't been so modest. We've put our work in this old city, New Rumours. I'm very grateful to Ian for the time he took in helping me put the book together, and for contacting the poets in the original anthology, and also for coming up with the title, Old City, New Rumours, which I think does everything that a title should do. It just has a little echo of the earlier book, but also hints at new work and perhaps less well-known work. I'd like to also thank the publisher, Ross Bradshaw of Five Leaves Press. He's not able to be here tonight, unfortunately, but I am very grateful to him and to Five Leaves for taking on such a book at a time when, you know, it is difficult to sell. It's always difficult to sell poetry, but it's particularly difficult at the moment. I'd like to thank the Larkin Society, with whom the book is in association with whom the book is published. I'd like to thank also Martin Goodman for giving us this space to present and launch the anthology in the last of the excellent series of Philip Larkin Centre readings. I think I'm not going to go on anymore because you want to hear the poets. So I'll tell you the running order. In the first half, we have Tony Petch, Tony Griffin, Ian Gregson, Angela Layton, Cliff Forshaw, and Maurice Rutherford. And I'm going to introduce the first three poets, and then the next two, and then the last poet, Maurice, separately. So this is really to save time. So I hope it's not confusing, but you'll get the names and the introductions in one go, but just for small groups. So our first poet is Tony Petch, who appears in A Rumoured City and in the new anthology, of course. Tony Petch graduated in forestry from the University of Edinburgh, and he later trained as a social worker. His latest collection is Vanishing Point, and published by Ragged Raven Press. I find him an unusual and imaginative poet who can write both at at length and expansively and also very pithily and interestingly. Our second poet is Tony Griffin, again a poet who has a long association with Hull. His collections include Cavita from Shoestring and The Leveller from Flux Gallery Press. And a festschrift for his 60th birthday was published last year and edited by one of the poets who's going to be reading later, Ian Parks. And then finally in this little group, it'll be Ian Gregson, who, as you know, edited this anthology, was in the first book, and has a substantial number of critical books to his credit, but also is an extremely interesting poet. His first collection, Call Centre Love Song, was shortlisted for a Forward Prize, and he's published more recently a collection from Salt, whose name I can't remember. Will you shout it out, Ian, please, for me?
How We Met.
Okay, thank you. So please give a welcome to the first three poets in this half, beginning with Tony Petch.
Wow. It's not often you get an audience this size at a poetry reading. It's very good to be invited along to read. I feel very privileged and would like to thank Carol and Ian for doing such a good job with the book. We haven't got much time, so I'll get straight on with the first poem. I'm going to read two poems. The first one's called The Holding. Instead of a hole, the string, or maybe the shed kept together, an entire garden tied. Hold me, you say. I breathe you in, a bud opening. So close to a rose could be nothing. And how far away? The original kept warm yet thin. The waste wasted if it's not as elegant as the string. Yellow and black. Yellow and black and the wings. A point being a corner of the shape where Dad leans his spades. A clarity is both protected and retained. As description, a plot divided between development and execution. A thorn in, back to front. Not buckthorn, but hawthorn. To replace a crop, a line of parsnips, the second row to steal from, your worship. Social inquiry means to set a record straight, to pay the penalty of each paragraph, poor sod. A long way from stripes round, the sun tanning our backs as we hoe between the carrots. The second poem I'm going to read was a number of people who haven't been able to be invited or included in this evening, and we're very limited, but to give a representation, I'm going to read one of somebody else's poems who's not here tonight. There are a lot of good poems in the book, well, they're all good, and a lot I like, and it's been hard to choose another one. But this one's by Andy Fletcher, and it's called Meeting You. Meeting You. I go to the station to meet you. The train stops at the buffers. Passengers with suitcases and bags get off. I look through the faces for yours. The next day, I go to the station to meet you. Pigeons flap into the air as the train pulls in. People step off, wave to relations, light cigarettes, hug loved ones. Every day I go to the station to meet you. Soon, from the mass of faces, I know you'll appear and smile. Years pass. The station's refurbished. Old trains are replaced by new ones. Timetables change. Still, I stand on the platform. Litter blows towards me. Plastic bags rise from the tracks. Each day, I go to the station to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here. Or as George Best said once, it's nice to be anywhere. The canal. If all else was still, we would come to this place from a lattice past, and you would be my centre. Then I too would be your centre. And we, knowing there was nothing but an outward circle and a still home, would be like two grey swans. But on the canal, the swans, like us, move in bruised water. The climb. If I came down now from Pendle Hill into the punishing rain and fought my way through Sabden into another morning, I would find a hard and clear day. I would leave the echoes of the mist and listen to the noises of you not returning. But I have put a distance between the day and the alterless night. It is both punishment and the reality of dream. Listen to what sounds come from this perpetual stance. What enigmas. And finally, winter sun. Winter sun falls through a window onto a tired but happy man. Outside, the January blossom from a Japanese cherry tree makes him think of his young lover placing a simple plant on her mother's grave. And he knows that she now knows things that he knows. As his mind opens like a flower, he sees at last the forming of a complete circle. Thank you.
I started writing this poem in 1976, and I've just finished it. It's about a line a year. I was living in the Avenues, doing a PhD, and I had a landlady who was senile there, and she used to wander around the streets and look kind of vacantly at people as they went by. And she had a housekeeper, and I invented, even then, a relationship between the housekeeper and the landlady, where the housekeeper was trying to annex the past of the landlady, partly based on a kind of scrapbook that was there in the flat where I lived, which was her life in the 1930s as a young bride with her husband and so on. And it, so it was always about this kind of attempt to take over somebody's past. And I think, actually, that, you know, the growth of that poem, and it obviously grew very slowly and was complete rubbish for 30 years, was helpful for me in terms of inventing a kind of poem where one person thinks about another's state of mind and the kind of weirdnesses that happen, which is something we all do when you think about what's it like to be that person and what are they feeling and so on. So it's a dramatic monologue, and I'm just going to read this one, The Housekeeper, just to show I've just finished it. It's in the latest Rialto. So. I envy the pre-war dinner dances in her scrapbook. Long menus, photos of flushed smilers grouped in evening wear, the cards that booked her, she was 17, for named dances with gentlemen partners. Owners of these spacious bay-windowed houses now divided into flats, and their sons, like Kenneth, how he steps out of the group and smiles alone, and then with her engaged, and then in uniform, the RAF, and then blank pages. So I think of him returning to find her so ancient, pushing a pram the length of the avenue. He crosses between then and now and suffers the gap like jet lag, not fitting where it's so much later, but he's still so young. But when I wear her braided, broad-shouldered jacket, cock feathers awry on her small felt hat, it's Kenneth who watches, who directs the period drama in the mirror. It's his need invents me as her body double, in her place whose pram is stuffed with litter and dead leaves like shriveled faces. Kenneth latent behind her as in a driver's blind spot, a street lamp warming his pallor, where the sycamores droop with withered fists. I mix another mojito and sip and gaze into its drowned vegetation. I'm confused between before and after. I'm a backseat passenger who sees in the rearview mirror the green trees unwinding from the driver's nape. I watch her push the pram, seeing a past that couldn't happen and leaving my reflection shuddering in the puddles. All the scene found wanting, not at all exotic, thirsting to be watched. Thank you.
Thank you. Philip Larkin said, in what I imagine was a typically downbeat manner, that the good thing about Hull was that it was a place that let you write. It didn't stop you writing poems. I think that's also true of the university. The university does encourage poetry, and particularly in recent years with the forming of the Larkin Centre. We've had a very distinguished contingent of poets coming to read and to conduct workshops, in some cases with the MA students. And of course we now have some up-and-coming MA poets who I'm sure will be featured in the anthologies of the future. Well, our next two readers have been both on the teaching staff. In Angela Layton's case, she worked here for many years before in 2006. I'm so bad at numbers, sorry. In 2006, she went to be a senior research fellow in Cambridge, Trinity College. So she's gone on to very great things. Angela is a critic and has written a number of critical volumes, a specialist in the Victorian poets. But she's also a poet whose most recent collection is Sea Level, which was published in 2007. Her first collection, A Cold Spell, appeared in 2000. And I'm told she has a new book, so far untitled, which we're all looking forward to, and which will be published next year, 2011. After Angela, you'll hear from Cliff Forshaw, who needs no introduction to many of you, I'm sure. His work, most recently published, is a collection of poems called Trans, which was in 2005. And he's also published a chapbook with Flairstack called Wake, which was the joint winner of the Flairstack Pamphlet Collection Award in 2008. So we have some excellent poets now who are associated with the university, one who was and one who still is, and whose work appears in the new anthology. So please welcome the first reader, Angela Layton.
Thank you very much, Carol. It's very good to be back in Hull, where I taught for many years at the university, many happy years. And it's been amazing to see, too, how the creative writing enterprise in the department has just flourished in the last 10 years, I think it is. Creative writing did, of course, as Carol said, always flourish in Hull. It's something to do with the air, or perhaps being left alone. And I hope it continues to do so. I'm going to read, if I've got the timing right, just three poems, two short ones. The first is from that, from the collection, and the other two are newer. The first is Sortilege. They grow to forgetful hands, fasten in fists, quick-footed into our shoes, hitching a lift. Then see through themselves in a mirror, furtive chances, cleared, lost to the world, tricks of the weather. Their makeup makes us up, their genes inflect, and givens seem a gift, a kind of luck. They gravitate through us, from smile to cry, still staring out in wonder from our eyes. A fright, I tell myself, and touch to know the mirror's cold assertion, half my own. The dead come home to us, their last resort. My face is yours, reformed, a home of sorts. The next poem is called At Brimham Rocks. Some of you may know it. It's in the Dales, where the millstone grit has been forced up from an ancient seabed, and it's been twisted into grotesque and eerie shapes by the weather. It's quite close to the bit of Yorkshire where I was born, and so there's a certain sort of emotional, personal resonance in the poem. There's also a distant rhyme scheme which you might pick up. In the winterings of the upper air, what's thrown up looks weathered to the bone. Why should we stop on a windy plateau? Cousins to freak accidents of snow, of stone, in the late distant sun, at the end of a lengthening day, almost done. This 300 million year old grit, tooled and twisted, chiseled by air, layered by millennial falling rains, makes an outing in our atmosphere, as if in answer to a game of dare, time's slow dancer, geomancer. It's rough stuff, this sedimentary grit, quartz and feldspar stashed in a pack from pages laid under prehistoric seas, deposited in sheets of bedrock, till some shift forced it up and made these earth-wrung torsos infolds of shock. In the winterings of the upper air, queer as dream lots cast on the brain, these millstone tors stipple the hilltop, turned in the turns of wind and rain, as if Earth's slow imagination stored artworks in earthworks, grain by grain. And the last poem is called Chanterelle. You might just need to know the two meanings of chanterelle. One is that it's a kind of edible fungus, but the other one, less well known, but it's spelt the same, is that it's the highest string of a musical instrument. The epigraph is a line taken from Montale, L'incanto se non il canto, which I actually took from a poem of Carol Ruman's, which I think we read when we used to meet for creative writing workshops. And it was a line that somehow migrated, as these things do, into my brain and stayed with me for some years and then sort of found its place. So, in memory of our workshops. Apricot flesh, a fluted neck, leaf mould grown to a perfect earlobe, cocked, a queer hat, horn of gold, a honeycomb on its own foothold, and light lawn in a trash of leaves, this fat of the earth, sumptuous jest, thumbing its right to stop my step, trusts a name to sing of itself, and sing is exact, a top string A, pitched in thin air as clear as day, draws out the chant in enchantment's weather, and makes a sound, a little singer. Thank you.
Hi, it's been very good being here in Hull for several reasons. One is something that happens annually and starts happening in a week or so, the Humbermount Festival. Over the years, I've been here 5 years, and over those 5 years, with various people at the university, we've done four projects. The first was with Carol and David. We did a performance at the Ferns Theatre. The year after, we did a book of photographs and poems called Architects. The year after that, poems, photographs, and a film called Drift about the coast. And this year, we've done one about wildlife, bird life, particularly Forings, the wildlife reserve over the other side of the Humber Bridge. And there will be a launch for that book, quick plug, on July the 2nd, which is a Friday at Artlink. But I'd like to read a couple of poems from those projects. The first one was Architects. This is about 3 or 4 years ago now. This is called Double O. And when I first came to Hull, it seemed to still be being built. And I got off at Paragon Railway Station before you had St. Stephen's Mall and the great mall of materialism and all the rest of it. And there was just this very fantastically gritty, awful place. So Double O, this is called Paragon Railway Station Hull. Paragon purrs, whoosh doors, whistles, maglev trains rise, aim at squares of wheat are gone on the dot towards sandpaper wrinkles painted on the sea. Your chopper's eye shows an immaculate reef knot, motorways, A-roads, underpasses, flyovers slip through each other to bays, estates, leafy, neat, neighborly streets with health and leisure centers, big screen complexes, escalators coil round marinas, malls swoop to galleries, cathedrals, gleaming
academic towers. Maybe to mock us. There are mock-ups of all this in the mayor's office, balsa, perspex, card, wire, felt, Hornby 00 trees, hand-painted families, cross-concourse, zoom high, to where the dinky hatchbacks are unstacked from sky. A couple of sniffs of cotton wool are caught on one lonely chimney. Back at Paragon, the facelifted station is where the future seems to have run out of steam. From up there, you'd see DIY factories, Texas, home base, B&Q, and further beyond where Spurn's thin bird bone of sand drifts in from the east, the estuary, the nightbound ferry, the wake from the lit up P&O. The second poem is from another project we did together here, and it was called Drift. And this one's called Authentic Victorian Mermaid. If you go to Hull Maritime Museum, you will find an authentic Victorian mermaid, a thing that was stitched together by sailors on long voyages and purported to be a real mermaid. It's black, it's about this big, it has a very freaky smile, and here it is, Authentic Victorian Mermaid. They fetch up here, scuttled to ledges, beached on pediments, among scrimshaw harpoons, a whaler's bow, a carved baleen seat. Bony leviathans ghost hugely through tall ships' sails. This gallery's a tail flick, the next's speared by a narwhale's horn. Your thoughts turn krill. The floor's a humpback. The stairwell spirals up inside a blowhole's spout. You're Jonah in the belly of the whale. Then boat back up to shore, strange creatures. You can't hear, no sirens sweetly singing, but see the black nightmare maid screech. Check spatulate fishtail, witchy fingers, stitch sealskin, your face to face with a scary Victorian freak, snarked on that gob of tiny fish hooky teeth.
Please.
I have not finished. I will finish with Ned Kelly. This is from a series of poems I came out called A Hymnal for Ned Kelly, and it's a sonnet of sorts. It's a version of Sidney Nolan's paintings of Ned Kelly, the famous Australian bushranger. Sidney Nolan's paintings iconized, I suppose is the word, the helmet in a black square, and all you could see was Ned Kelly's eyes. And there were a series of paintings, I can't remember how many, but a couple of dozen, and you see the eyes. And this is the first poem, and it's called Ned Kelly's Eyes, after Sidney Nolan. That's him, that awkward shadow, that black, that's Ned. He's painted out as if already dead. Sometimes it's just a blank, that slit for eyes. You look right through the man to clear blue skies. Sometimes the void's red tinge with fire or dawn, the burbling billy can, the day's first yawn. Sometimes the clouds and that gash blush with dusk. Sky buries its burning cheek down in the lonely chimney. Back at Paragon, the facelifted station is where the future seems to have run out of steam. From up there, you'd see DIY factories, Texas, home base, B&Q, and further beyond where Spurn's thin bird bone of sand drifts in from the east, the estuary, the nightbound ferry, the wake from the lit-up P&O. The second poem is from another project we did together here, and it was called Drift. And this one's called Authentic Victorian Mermaid. If you go to
Hull Maritime Museum, you will find an authentic Victorian mermaid, a thing that was stitched together by sailors on long voyages and purported to be a real mermaid. It's black, it's about this big, it has a very freaky smile, and here it is. Authentic Victorian mermaid. They fetch up here, scuttled to ledges, beached on pediments, among scrimshaw harpoons, a whaler's bow, a carved baleen seat. Bony leviathans ghost hugely through tall ships' sails. This gallery's a tail flick, the next's speared by a narwhale's horn. Your thoughts turn krill. The floor's a humpback. The stairwell spirals up inside a blowhole's spout. You're Jonah in the belly of the whale. Then boat back up to shore. Strange creatures, you can't hear, no sirens sweetly singing, but see the black nightmare maid screech. Check spatulate fishtail, witchy fingers, stitch sealskin, your face to face with a scary Victorian freak, snarked on that gob of tiny fish hooky teeth.
Please.
I have not finished. I will finish with Ned Kelly. This is from a series of poems I came out called A Hymnal for Ned Kelly. And it's a sonnet of sorts. It's a version of Sidney Nolan's paintings of Ned Kelly, the famous Australian bushranger. Sidney Nolan's paintings, iconized, I suppose is the word, the helmet in a black square, and all you could see was Ned Kelly's eyes. And there were a series of paintings, I can't remember how many, but a couple of dozen, and you see the eyes. And this is the first poem, and it's called Ned Kelly's Eyes, after Sidney Nolan. That's him, that awkward shadow, that black, that's Ned. He's painted out as if already dead. Sometimes it's just a blank, that slit for eyes. You look right through the man to clear blue skies. Sometimes the void's red tinge with fire or dawn, the burbling billy can, the day's first yawn. Sometimes the clouds and that gash blush with dusk. Sky buries its burning cheek down in the dust. Sometimes there's a flash of silver. Say, sardines, that peel-back strip you've keyed along the tin. He has no eyes in the back of his head, of course. Sometimes he rides away. Black gun, black horse, into another picture. What's forged by Smith from black still fileth then. And riding into myth. Thank you.
Thank you, Angelo and Cliff. Our next poet is going to end this half of the evening, and I'm very pleased that he's been able to come tonight. For me, he was a completely new discovery. His name is Maurice Rutherford. He's of the same generation as Philip Larkin. He's a well-published poet, but somebody whose work I hadn't come across and wouldn't have had not Ross Bradshaw, the Five Leaves publisher, said to me, do you know a poem called The Autumn Outings by Maurice Rutherford? And no, I said I didn't. So I did a little bit of research and discovered that he'd published a wonderful collection. He's published other collections, but most recently a collection with Peter Lou, now no longer a company, called Love is a Four-Letter World. And there I found this poem, which I greatly admired. And I discovered many good things about Maurice Rutherford's work. And only one of them is really that he actually argues with Larkin. But I do like that aspect. I, I've always found it among Irish poets that they talk to each other and they fight with each other in language, I hasten to add, and they get ideas and spark off, well, sometimes literally, and they get ideas from each other. And it was exciting to find a poet who was actually in conversation with Philip Larkin. The poets in the anthology in no way form a Larkin school, and they're extremely diverse. They really reflect the diversity of current poetry writing. But anyway, I won't go on any more, because I know you're looking forward to hearing Maurice Rutherford read as much as I am. He's here, and he's going to end this first half. So please give a big welcome to Maurice Rutherford.
Hello. It's 8 years since last I was here in Hull, and it really is a pleasure for me to be here in this first week of Larkin 25 and at the launch of Old City, New Rumours. What isn't a pleasure is that something to find that the gist of something that I wrote 18 years ago has followed us into this century and is still relevant today. Carol has already mentioned that the poem is called The Autumn Outings. It's on page 107 of the anthology. It obviously pays homage to one of Philip Larkin's great masterpiece poems, The Wits and Weddings, but it's about quite a different kind of wedding. And unlike Larkin's narrator, apart from the action, observing the doings of other people, the speaker here is very much involved in what's going on. I imagined him as being someone who started his working life as an apprentice in an engineering company and worked his way up to be its general manager, as in those days was quite possible and indeed very likely. He's probably reached the age of 50, and the boom years are over. The business is going downhill fast, the firm losing money, and he fears the day when the owners pull the plug and he's left with the job of bringing the workforce together and telling them that they're all out of a job, following them down the road, dropping the keys off on the way home, and goodnight Vienna. We meet him in October 1992, and he is recalling the events of that time and then going on to struggle with his own dispiritment, his own embitterment. That autumn, I was quick getting away, only about 1:20 on the rain-drenched Wednesday. I locked the premises and motored out. All staff sent home. All workshop plant closed down. All sense of any kind of business gone. And not until I'd driven 15 miles along fast flooding roads back into town, past rival complexes just clinging on, did rain let up and vision clear. Those files I'd never see again. That desk, the phone that shrilled all day when first it was installed, not hear the moan compressors made, be soothed by lathes, not say, "Come on in, George, all right," or "Nice one, Bert." The human touch, no more. Not to distract them too long from their work, but just enough to let them see I cared, and not to hurt old feelings as I tried to breast the fact of cancelled orders, creditors turned rough, the friendly bank soon bared its teeth, drew blood, and then that bane, the taxman, claimed his pound, and so the flood. Fine detail dims again, as two the pain recedes, three autumns on, yet loss stays true. The rain comes vicious now, wipers full speed, dipped headlights on, rear fogs. The journey seems to lengthen every time I live it through, involuntarily, as when the need for sleep is scuppered by recurring dreams. My crowd was breastfed cliches, meal on meal, to pull its weight, nose to the grindstone, shoulder to the wheel, and once it stopped, stepped inside the factory gate, was wedded to its work, slapped all the time by new boat's hand, play up and play the game. Well, this sounds fine, but what about the bloke who's anorexic, short-nosed, cannot climb to reach the wheel, and never makes the team? For him, such wedding tales are guffs of smoke. Again, the morning paper hits the floor, banner headlined, pit closures shock. An umpteen thousand more are facing broken marriages to mines. A few, lured by that bit of fresh fool's gold, pin hopes on boarding houses, market stalls. One man sits out his protest down the pit, while lefties call for strikes with all the old clenched fist salutes and aerosol the walls. Scargill for king, and Tarzan is a shit. The first few days in idleness will see, in those it hits, undreamt of traits in personality. Some will get by, and others go to bits. The strong become the weak. The weak make good as quickly as it's said. Then, as the days stack up to months, or, as in my case, years, high principles get trampled in the mud, where guile and self-survival point new ways to quick back pocket jobs, fiddles, and fears of being caught. But fears will yield, in time, a sort of pride, though not the social pride that saw men climb from old world swamps, a sense that one's defied the odds, the system, finger-licked the creme, nose-thumbed some top brass, bested those who made the rules and all the running. What survives? Of us, too early yet to tell. Of them, indifferent and incapables, their trade in UB-40s and P-45s. In brass-lined boardrooms, up and down the land, deep in regret, a million more redundancies get planned, while chairmen's hiked-up salaries are set and urban councils chase arrears in rents. Wide boys, insider dealers, some MPs grow richer by a second home in Spain, a custom-plated white Mercedes-Benz, that new portfolio, true blue disease, the spores of loss somewhere becoming gain. Thank you.
Thank you, Maurice, and Thank you to all the poets who took part in the first half. And thank you also for reading within the sadly limited space that we had to allow for tonight. It means that we can have a reasonable interval, I think, until 8:20. Hope that's all right. So it'll give you a chance to perhaps buy a drink and certainly to buy a book. The books are on sale tonight at a special discount price of £7. And for the contributors, they're reduced to £4. So please do buy copies, and I'm sure many of the poets would be happy to sign your copy. Okay, so see you in 20 minutes' time for the second half. Please just give one more round of applause to all our readers. Thank you.